This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Some have straight lines along county borders and roadways, carving out identifiable chunks of Florida. Others meander, they bob, they weave, they stitch together bits of neighborhoods and towns into a political district. Every 10 years, the Florida legislature draws lines on a state map, marking where one congressional district begins and another one ends. The Florida state constitution now requires lawmakers to ignore political parties and incumbents when establishing those legislative boundaries. A Florida circuit court judge will decide if lawmakers ignored the state constitution, though, when they drew political maps for U.S. congressional districts in Florida. Critics argue the boundaries came out of secret meetings and backroom deals to favor Republicans. Legislators say the allegation of a shadow process is concocted and the congressional districts are fair. Well, what was the process? Who was involved? What is evidence and what is merely political intrigue? Let us know your thoughts on the political redistricting court case here at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or send us a tweet at WLRN, or join the conversation online at WLRN.org. Our guests on the Florida Roundup include Rosemary Goodrow, Sun Sentinel editorial page editor, Lauren Pastrana with CBS Miami reporter, Mary Ellen Kloss, Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times with us in Tallahassee, along with Gary Fineout with the Associated Press. Gary, you've been in the courtroom during the arguments here. What's the central claim in the lawsuit, Gary?
Well, the central claim is that the congressional map is unconstitutional because lawmakers did draw the map with the intent to favor Republicans. And they did that primarily by sort of altering some of the districts in such a way that they packed Democrats into a handful of specific districts in a way to make certain other districts more favorable to Republicans.
Now, Mary Ellen, this trial is focused on the 27 U.S. congressional districts here in Florida, and the 2012 election specifically. How did that election change the makeup, if at all, of the Florida congressional delegation?
Well, because of Florida's population growth, in the 2012 election, Florida was given two additional congressional seats. So we went from 25 to 27. And as a result of reapportionment, Democrats gained a net increase of four additional seats. So the result was Democrats did see an increase. So did Republicans, because of they actually lost one seat that they thought they would win, which was David Rivera's seat in Miami, won by Joe Garcia. So, but there was a net increase for Democrats, but there also was an increase for Republicans because of the additional two seats.
Rosemary Goodrow with the Sun Sentinel editorial board. Critics of the map argue that President Obama, Democrat, won the state of Florida in 2008, won the state of Florida in 2012, yet there are 10 congressional districts that are considered Democratic if you look at the state. That's politics, though, not a mapping process, isn't it?
It's surprising to know there are more registered Democrats in Florida than there are Republicans, and yet Republicans control the pen in drawing these lines because they controlled the pen last time, and the seats that have been drawn favor Republicans. The disappointment for people in this is that we were led to believe with these hearings that were being held around the state, taking public testimony, that our lawmakers were going to draw districts that truly were fair, that made sense, that kept cities and counties together and didn't, you know, divide a cul-de-sac based on how residents voted. And the hope in that is that if we had realistic districts, that the people they elected would be people who were somewhere in the middle and not so far to the right and so far to the left. And so for those of us who wanted to believe that this process truly would be fair, what we learned in this hearing, in this incredible hearing trial that we just witnessed, is that there was subterfuge. There were emails that went missing and people who submitted maps that they had never seen before in closed door meetings, and it was anything but fair.
And Gary, I'm going to ask you about some of this evidence versus intrigue and some of the allegations that Rosemary's talking about here. But Lauren Pastrana, Florida is increasingly becoming not a red state and not a blue state. It's increasingly become a purple state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It really has. And just going off of what Ms. Goodrow was saying here and talking about about the maps versus the political process. I mean, just because someone votes for a Democrat for president doesn't mean they can't vote for a Republican for a congressional seat. But there is some interest in seeing how it's so skewed one way or the other when you look at these different districts.
Gary, take us inside that courtroom, because we heard testimony, for instance, from the Senate president of the state of Florida, Don Gates, saying he wasn't sure if he knew how to delete emails when asking about missing emails from his office. We heard about meetings between Don Gates, the Senate president, and the House Speaker Will Weatherford before the maps were officially public, about not a secret meeting, they claimed. The door was open, they said, to the meeting, although nobody else was inside the room except for the two of them. So talk to us about the kinds of testimony that we heard and what seems to be the judge's interpretation of the evidence versus the allegations of intrigue that we heard.
Well, on the second part, it's going to be hard for us to figure out exactly how the judge views all this evidence, because unfortunately, a key part of evidence was never heard by the public, which is there were emails and documents and maps obtained from a Republican consultant out of Gainesville. And by virtue of litigation involving a First Amendment claim having to do with what's called associational privilege, we were sort of kicked out of the courtroom while that evidence was presented to the judge.
Yeah, so this is more than 500 pages of evidence that was by a political consultancy based in Gainesville, right?
Correct. And the point is that we don't know what those emails and maps and documents said.
Data targeting was the name of that company.
Yeah. Data targeting is the name of the company. It's a company that's been paid quite a bit of money by the Republican Party over the last several years.
Millions of dollars.
And in fact, their legal costs are also being borne by the Republican Party. So unfortunately, in terms of what the judge has to work with, we don't have the full picture as members of the media and members of the public. Now, what we do know is that we got some insights into Tallahassee, things that we sort of thought were the way things worked and always assumed the way that they work, but they were forced to testify this is the way they work, which is essentially there's a meeting before the meeting. When you and I watch things on the, you know, either watch it in person on the Florida Channel or what have you, we think, okay, this is the public meeting. Well, in reality, there was a meeting before the meeting to decide what's going to happen in the meeting. And just like we discovered that it's routine for staff to just completely delete emails all over the place in the legislature. Now, as anyone who follows local government or other parts of state government know, you can't do that. You can't just routinely delete all your emails and get rid of all your documents. But the legislature has the power to do it, and they maintain to us, this is just normal procedure. This wasn't done just to deal with redistricting, even though they had sort of been put on notice that a lawsuit was coming.
Gary Fineout covers the state legislature for the Associated Press. Marilyn Kloss also does that from Tallahassee for the Miami Herald and for the Tampa Bay Times. Mary Ellen, as Gary mentions, boy, the cloak really came off some of the meetings before the meetings during the testimony that we heard over the redistricting of Florida congressional maps. The question remains, though, kind of what is the possible outcome of this court case as the judge is accepting written closing arguments in the weeks ahead and then moves toward some kind of decision, presumably before the end of the month?
Well, it's going to be very interesting. This case has been the precedent setting from the very beginning because it's the first time, obviously, we're applying these new fair district standards. But I think whatever the judge does is ultimately going to be challenged because it is so precedent setting. And the judge has a couple of options. He can basically say, reject the claims of the plaintiffs and say, sorry, you don't have a case. It looks like there may have been some shenanigans, but it's not enough to prove that the legislature intended to draw districts that benefit Republicans. Or he could say, yes, there is. It does appear that there was intent to favor a party or an incumbent in these particular areas, and you need to go and redo the map in those areas. Or he could just throw out the whole map and say start over. How he resolves that is unknown. We don't know if he's going to say the court should redraw it. We don't know if he would throw it back and have the legislature do it. And the odds of anything getting resolved before the November elections, because of all that uncertainty and because of the likely challenge, are very slim. We are unlikely to see any of this settled before November.
Rosemary Goudreau with the Sun Sentinel editorial board. Proving intent in a criminal case is difficult. Proving it in this kind of civil case has got to be darn near impossible. And that really is among the crux of the arguments of the plaintiffs, arguing that there was intent on the part of Florida legislative leaders to redraw the congressional map to favor an incumbent, which would be unconstitutional. It's a pretty high hurdle.
Absolutely. I think that the evidence shows that there absolutely was skewing of the lines going on. One of the questions for people who observe, though, is how do we ever get to a place where political lines can be drawn fairly? And it said that so long as the pen is held by the politicians, whether they be Republican or Democrats, and Democrats like Corinne Brown are not blameless in this argument.
She's the representative for what's now the 5th District, the U.S. Congressional 5th District in Florida, which stretches from Jacksonville. It dips south, it goes southwest, then includes parts of Gainesville, then it swings back southeast to just west of Orlando. I mean, this really is, when you look at it on a map, the definition, it's got to be a definition of a gerrymandering district.
This is a Democrat who is fighting for a gerrymandered district. So my point is that as long as politicians hold the pen, we are going to get districts that are drawn to favor politicians who control the pen. Can we get a blue ribbon commission to do this? It's argued, well, who appoints those members? Politicians, so it's still there. Even if you appoint a panel of judges, oh, politicians will appoint them. My argument is let's pick a jury. We are able to pick a jury for people who decide life and death for people. Surely we can use real voters to pick to create a panel that can create the lines that define political life.
I can only imagine the summons, Lauren, for jury duty to sit on the committee to decide the political districts for the state of Florida.
But that's why I honestly think that this trial, as precedent setting as it is just really interesting. And I hope people are following it and learning things from it, because otherwise you don't think about this in your everyday life. You don't go to the polls wondering, oh, well, how is my district drawn? And you don't think about that. So maybe if it does work as a jury type system, it would force people to really be interested in the political process in their state.
And certainly for those. Go ahead, Mary Ellen.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject something. There was we had a lot of expert testimony during the trial. And somebody was asked at one point, one of the experts who's a Caltech computer science geek, right? And they said, what is the best way to get, he said, these are the most biased districts he's ever seen across the country. And he's asked, how do you find it an unbiased way to do it? And he said, the only way to do it is to let a computer draw the line. I thought that was an interesting answer.
Well, listen, if we're willing to consider driverless cars on roadways in the state of Florida, then perhaps we're willing to consider computer-drawn congressional maps in the Sunshine State as well. Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald, Gary Finat with the Associated Press, Lauren Pastrana with CBS Miami, and Rosemary Goudreau with the Sun Sentinel editorial page editor. Along with me, I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Speaking of cars and driving, stay close here. Coming up, disrupting the taxi business in South Florida and doing it illegally. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. No medallion, no government regulation, no old school flagpole. Two car services are rolling around South Florida streets right now, picking up and dropping off passengers and doing so against the law. Lyft and UberX offer private passenger service through a network of private drivers using their own personal cars. Not taxi cabs, but maybe it's a Chevy Cruze or a Toyota Camry, even a Honda Civic. The companies are in business collecting fares and potentially collecting fines, despite the Miami-Dade Commission vote to not deregulate the taxi business. That vote happening earlier this year. Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez.
While I am in favor of the new technology, and I believe that our codes are outdated, our codes are still what they are, and we have to enforce our codes.
And that's what they're doing with these two illegal services now. Brian Leo is a driver for the Lyft service.
I didn't read the Florida statutes beforehand, but I didn't know that was a requirement to sign up for a job.
Between public safety and more transportation options, how about it? Do you support these new, albeit currently illegal, car service operations? Have you used UberX or Lyft to get around? Is South Florida a place to open new businesses that disrupt established businesses? Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Send us a tweet at WLRN or go online to our live web chat right now at WLRN.org. Lauren Pastrana with CBS Miami, Rosemary Goudreau with the Sun Sentinel editorial page, Glenn Garvin with the Miami Herald also along with us. Glenn, you took a few rides this week on Lyft and on UberX. What was the experience like?
Well, it worked pretty well, really. The way it works is this. You need a smartphone. You download an app for one or both of these companies. When you're ready to go someplace, you click on the app. It shows you a map, and you see immediately how close the nearest taxi driver is. And at that point, you can make a decision. If it's 20 miles and you don't want to wait that long, get out of the app and call a regular cab or make some other arrangements. But if you like what you see, you click on it. The app links you up. You see a picture of the driver and his car, so you know exactly who's coming for you and what it looks like. By the way, he sees your picture, too, if you sign in through Facebook, which is the most likely way to do
this. How about the cost of this? How did it compare to a regular medallion, highly regulated taxi drive?
Well, I'm reluctant to make judgments about that based on the three or four trips I took. To me, it seemed about the same as an ordinary taxi, but I know the car service companies are claiming very emphatically that their rates are cheaper. I think that's hard to calculate. In the one head-to-head test I did, I went from my home in Coral Gables to the Redbird Shopping Center at Bird Road and Red Road. It was a little bit under $10 in a regular taxi. It was $14. In a Lyft car.
Okay.
So, but I think you'd have to do a bigger study.
Sure,
to really,
you have a very small sample size,
right,
as the scientists would say. What about the comfort? Any concerns about your safety in these unregulated
Not
cars?
Not at all. The cars were much newer and much more comfortable than the average taxi.
Could you use a credit card? You have to use cash.
Yeah, this is all credit card. No cash changes hand. You can tip the driver in cash if you want to, or you can put the tip on the credit card.
Did the drivers know you were a journalist?
Not from my calling them, but very quickly as I got in the car, I was asking a lot of questions like, hey, where are you from? How old are you? That might have been a little bit unnerving coming from just a regular passenger. So, yeah, I told them I was a journalist.
So they did. All right. Diego Feliciano is joining us. He's the president of the South Florida Taxi Association. And, Diego, you and your taxi members and medallion holders have been against these unregulated car services. What's the response to Glenn's experience, albeit a small sample size, but one that presumably seemed to be pleasurable?
Well, let's start out that it's very nice for somebody to come into town and offer a service that was already being provided. After all, there's only so many customers in Dade County, and the fact is that the taxi cab service has to service all of them. They don't profile you. They will always come to you. They're their 24-hour service. The price is guaranteed by the government. They're inspected four times a year, carry commercial insurance, and a lot of other things that were there to protect the public. But that being aside, let's go to the fact about who they're picking up. Being that taxi cabs must pick up ADA people, wheelchair disadvantaged people, senile dogs, pick up in all neighborhoods. Imagine what's going to happen in a city where profiling is occurring, eventually you're going to call a service from somewhere, and they're not going to come because it's either a bad neighborhood, or it's just they don't tip well there, or whatever your profile came out to be the last time you ride.
Diego, let me ask you, if services, private, these peer-to-peer services like Lyft and UberX are, if they were held to the same kind of standards, the same kind of non-discriminatory standards in terms of the passenger pickups, would you support their entrance legally into the South Florida taxi car service market?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, when this all started, we asked these companies to come and work within the existing laws with the existing transportation providers.
What about if they didn't have to have medallions? If they were able to sign up and they were fulfilling all the kinds of regulations that you're talking about in terms of the non-discriminatory practices that your taxi association members are held to, but without a taxi medallion?
Absolutely not. We have a regulatory process that includes a count of customers and passengers that arrive at our airports, at our hotels, to determine the amount of transportation we need in Dade County. Anything other than that would cause a disaster. If you've seen the cabs around Lejeune during the hard times of the year, June, July, going around and around because there's no customers, we're still somewhat of a seasonal city. So if you're going to say that you're going to flood the cars, the street with cars during the most convenient times of the day for the most lucrative customers, then you're going to disrupt the whole system and eventually collapse the existing taxi cab system, which was providing service to all of the community, not to a certain segment of the community.
Diego Feliciano is president of the South Florida Taxi Association here on the Florida Roundup, talking about new unregulated and currently illegal car services, Lyft and UberX beginning operations here this week. Rosemary Goudreau with the Sun Sentinel, this debate right now is concentrated in Miami-Dade County, but it certainly could quickly encompass all of South Florida. A broader question here is South Florida going to be a place that can welcome disruptive technologies and disruptive industries into highly regulated and entrenched industries and do it in a way that that perhaps is fairest to all parties, including the consumer?
Well, change happens, and I get that it's difficult. The newspaper business has certainly seen a lot of change happen, and we are reinventing ourselves to deliver information in new ways. As you well know, radio has changed, and now we have satellite radio. And do you wish change didn't happen? Sure. But the best operators, you know, accept that change is going to happen, and they adapt, and they create a service that customers want and call on first. And for government to stand in the way of free market with regulations that keep entrepreneurs from meeting the needs in the marketplace is part of what our politics is all about. Get government out of the way. And yes, we want some protections, but to keep companies out of meeting the needs of a congested urban community is not the way of the future.
Lauren Pastrana with CBS Miami. But don't we do this in all kinds of highly regulated industries? We do it for public safety measures. We do it for public security measures. We do it for public fairness measures. Why is the car service industry perhaps any different? Or is it any different in your mind?
I think coming from a consumer standpoint or from a rider standpoint in this case, because this is not my area of expertise in any way, shape or form, but I just don't see how having one or two, Uber and Lyft, would do away with taxi cabs. We'll still need them. You go to certain areas of this city and you could hail a taxi cab rather quickly. On the beach where I live, I can still call one by standing out there on the corner. But in other areas, perhaps a little bit more rural, where it's not as easy to just find a cab driving down your street, I don't see why an application like UberX or Lyft wouldn't be beneficial. So like you say, I mean, change is good sometimes. And if it's to the benefit of the entire community, why not?
Glenn Garvin, Miami Herald.
Well, I think we can argue about the right and the wrong and the economics of this a lot. The fact is, this is coming and nobody's going to be able to stop it. It would take a monstrous, superhuman effort by county authorities to put these guys out of business. How are you going to do it? The cars are not recognizable because they're just private individuals' cars. A policeman on the street can't say, uh-oh, I think that guy's UberX. You could, I suppose, have county employees work as undercover agents calling these cabs and then busting them. But let me tell you, that won't work long either, because at the end of each ride, both the driver and the customer rate one another. The customer on this sort of things you would expect was the cabbie.
Four stars, five stars,
yeah,
courteous,
was he polite?
Clean, yeah.
The driver typically is going to rate the passenger on, you know, was he a drunk? Was he obnoxious? But he can also say, he's a narc. He's a county cop. Don't pick up this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, I think that's going to frustrate all attempts to wipe this out. I think the cab companies better get used to
I would like to talk
figuring out how to deal with us.
Diego Feliciano with the South Florida Taxi Association. I want to put that question to you, as a matter of fact, in terms of consumer ratings of your medallion holders and your drivers.
Yeah, let's start with the reinventing. The taxi cab industry is reinventing itself as we speak. It is lowering the amount, the time that a limousine has to wait to 15 minutes, which is how long it will take you to get downstairs. The difference is they're not a demand service vehicle. Let's go to the next part. We're about to have charge cards, GPS, an ambassador program for nicer cabs at the airport. And this is all about regulations, not reinventing the wheel. But let's go to the next part. Rural. When you said rural, you really think that these cabs are going to pick you, these illegal vehicles are going to pick up in rural areas? Once they find out the distance that they have to go, they have the ability to not only discriminate not to pick you up, but they can just push the button and say they're busy and not go to pick you up. So that's not going to happen, particularly in the areas that are not lucrative. Where you will have them is in Miami Beach and where there's a lot of money to be made, particularly since half of the population, let's say 60% of the population of Dade County, will never own an app because they're either too poor or they don't have the ability to have an iPhone. And so, therefore, we're discriminating against 60% of our population for a ride that's going to be just the cream of the crop, just the rich and wealthy people that can afford this ride.
All right.
And the rest of them will have to be serviced by the Dade County taxi cab industry. No, ma'am, you will collapse the taxi cab industry in Dade County.
Well, Diego, to be clear, South Florida has been seen as one of the highest adaptation rates of smartphones in the country, and a smartphone doesn't necessarily mean a $300 iPhone either. We've got several calls here on the line for our guests. Let's begin with Marcelo from Coral Gables. Welcome to the Florida Ronda. Marcelo, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I got a comment, not a question, and actually got two comments. The first comment is towards Diego. As a user of over 20 years of getting cash from the airport, you're being absolutely disingenuous, and you're inventing disaster upon disaster upon disaster to basically avoid a competitive framework. As a user, I welcome all of them, UberX, Lyft, whatever comes my way. They're more courteous. I have used them in New York. They accept credit cards. They really know their neighborhoods. And to be honest, I don't have to sit in some Miami dirty cab, and they're awful, all of them. Basically, your argument, Diego, is absolutely disproven by the fact that in New York, the cab still exists, and you got the other service.
Marcelo, let's let Diego here respond. And Diego, go ahead and respond to Marcelo, specifically about the cleanliness concerns that have been voiced for many years regarding regulated taxi cabs.
Ironically, you're absolutely wrong. Miami-Dade County doesn't want what New York wants. New York's cabs, Uber works within the existing taxi cabs. When you call Uber in New York, what comes to you is a regular taxi cab, sir. You know, what Uber wants to do in Dade County and Lyft is destroy the existing taxi cab industry in a non-level playing field.
Diego, is there a possibility to work with Lyft then? Is there a possibility the regulated taxis could become Lyft cars, become Uber X cars as well?
That is absolutely so, and we right now are in the process of doing business with Halo. We have a 500 cab company, Super Yellow, that has an app called Flywheel. You're all welcome to download it. You'll see the car coming to you, just like with any of the other apps. In the near future, every taxi cab, limo, and limo company in the state of in Florida will have an app, because we see that that's where it's going, and we're working on a universal app for the taxi cab industry. So apps are not the answer to the world. As far as the cleanliness, sir, I have to admit that there is a failure of our county to enforce regulations that are already there. When I go to that airport and I see drivers in sandals or flip-flops, and I see people with shorts, it's disgusting to me as the president of South Florida Taxi Cab Association. That's why we took it upon ourselves to forward this information to the county and to move with Commissioner Zapata, thank to him, to improve the taxi cab industry in Dade County for the public, which it desperately needs to do. And in the near future, we're going to have everything that is Uber cars, including cleaner cars. And I apologize to
all
you,
right,
sir.
Fair enough, Diego. Let's get to some more phone calls here. Andrew is joining the Florida Roundup from Miami. Andrew,
hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to relate an experience that I had last weekend. I was at a restaurant pretty late, and it was in Midtown, and I needed to take a cab back to my place in Biscayne area. And when I left the restaurant, there were four cabs lined up. And I walked up to the first cab and asked him if he could take credit cards. So that's what I needed to use. And he said, no, not taking credit card. He rolled up his window and rolled forward. talked to the second cab behind him, and this time just said, I need to go to the Biscayne area. And he responded, too short of a ride, not going to take you. No apology, nothing. And he rolled up his window and moved forward. When I got to the third cab, apparently he saw the other two reject me, and he didn't even roll down his window. I walked to the fourth cab, just got in, didn't tell him where I was going, didn't tell him I needed to use a credit card. He started driving. Then I told him where to go. He was upset. He voiced being upset about the short fare, I guess. And then when I got to my destination and I went to use the credit card, he said, no, I don't take credit cards. He had a credit card machine. But what he said is, there's no paper in there, so I can't do it. I can't do the transaction.
All right, this gets to the point of regulation, Diego, and certainly the conversation regarding the use of credit cards for Miami-Dade cabs has been ongoing. We do know that that is a program that will be rolling out. It'll take several years, but it is rolling out nonetheless. But the response to Andrew, these are complaints that I know, Diego, you're familiar with. Cabbies that don't want to accept short routes, cabbies that don't want to accept credit cards because of the administrative costs, the processing costs associated to it, and the possibility of a smaller tip as well with a credit card compared to cash.
Yes, first, Mr. Andrews, please, the next time that this happens to you, call the Consumer Service Department, or at least please write down the phone number of the cab. Call the company. A refusal of service is a $500 fine. That's whether you have a CNI dog or you're just a customer standing on the side of the road. $500 fines really hurt. The county listens very careful. They have a department that listens to the public. You have that one number to lodge complaints on. It's on all cabs. And I would appreciate that. Please, you know, forward this information. These are the kind of people we need to get rid of. On the other part, Dade County doesn't have a charge card ordinance in place right now. It should be not 2 years, but I understand within a year, all charge cards machines would be in all taxi cabs. My apologies for us for the slowness, but right now it's up to the taxi cab driver to have one or not have one. There's no rules around it. And the rules that we're going to put to these charge card machines are so powerful that we'll be able to shut it down, including their radio dispatch, including their system to operate and pick up passengers from a remote location if they refuse a ride, and we see on our computer that they refuse to ride. So technology's coming to us a little slower than we wish, but pretty soon we're going to have everybody on a GPS. We'll know whether they picked up the fare. Refusal of fares will cost them first suspensions and then money. So we're looking forward to all this to improve our destination of Dade County as a world-class city. And again, we're moving as quickly as we can, and we understand the frustration of the public.
And Diego, you mentioned something about Miami being a world-class city, and for a lot of visitors, Glengarvan, when they come out of MIA, their first greeting or their very preliminary greeting to Miami could be certainly a cab driver.
That's right. And, you know, I take cabs from the airport a fair amount. I live, as it happens, in the North Gables. That's only about a $15 fare for a cabbie picking me up at the airport. And they don't like it. And they are very clear about not liking it. I've had guys try to make me get out of the cab, though I've always said, you'll be sorry, and they backed off. They're hostile. They slam my luggage around. On occasion, they try and overcharge me, even though it's a set route. I don't worry so much about guys wearing flip-flops and shorts. I don't care about that. But it shouldn't be a hostile experience to take a cab. And frankly, when you get in a cab at the airport and you're going to some place that the cab driver doesn't think is lucrative enough, it is a hostile experience.
Grace joining us on the Florida Roundup from Miramar. Grace, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I actually work in the hospitality industry, and I definitely welcome, you know, the taxis and, you know, updating their systems, but we're really, really behind in technology. I think a lot of our customers and clients and guests that stay with us just carry credit cards. They don't really want to carry cash. I mean, they've told us about the same thing as our previous callers, hostile.
Grace, let me ask you work in the hospitality industry. Are you gearing some of your guests away from calling cabs and having concierges call Lyft and UberX?
You know, we haven't been given that permission, but we have been talking about it, and we do have the process. I personally haven't, but I definitely welcome it. I would love it to be, I would love for it not to be illegal, because we definitely don't want to put our clients in kind of in that situation. But it's definitely a problem. We get a lot of clients that tell us, you know, they're waiting 15 minutes for a taxi cab. They're not having that luck when they get in. They've been told that we have to pay cash, or they have to go to the front desk, and we have to give them a cash advance. And it's just a lot of negative kind of perception of Miami, and that's definitely something we don't want as a hospitality. It's so driven here in Miami. We definitely need some assistance with making that first experience a wonderful experience and not a bad experience.
Yeah, and Grace from Miramar, thanks for the phone call. And Glenn, that's exactly what you were talking about, not only for visitors, but for us residents as well.
Right. I'd also like to just clarify something. Though Lyft and UberX are operating illegally, they don't have the right licenses, they don't have the right insurance, it's illegal for them. So far as I know, and I'm 99.5% certain I'm correct about this, it's not illegal for a passenger to use
to pay somebody else, right, to drive them somewhere else, essentially.
The passenger, right, is not,
you're not
has
a John,
no legal liability.
Yeah, you're not a vehicle John, as the right case may be. Right. Joseph is joining us from Miami. Joseph, you are a regulated taxi driver. Is that right?
Yeah.
Have you seen your business impacted this week with UberX and Lyft on the roads?
This is June. Usually starting end of May, this is low in Miami-Dade County.
Right,
so there is not much, there is no way to fire out.
Yeah,
because in June, business is usually low.
Business is low. Do you take credit cards, Joseph?
No.
You do not? Do you have a credit card machine?
No. The reason I do not have it, if I open a merchant account, they are going to charge me $30 every month, even if I pick up, if I get a credit card transaction or not.
The processing fee as well. Well, Joseph, be safe out there. We will let you go. Keep your eyes on the road. Diego Feliciano, president of South Florida Taxi Association. We've got to bring this conversation to a bit of an end, but your message to the complaints that you heard here on the Florida Roundup, you've heard these kinds of complaints before. I'd like you to have an opportunity, and you've talked already about some specific complaints, but generally, is the taxi business in South Florida, if we were to have this conversation a year from now and Lyft and UberX and other peer-to-peer car services were operating legally, is that going to be beneficial to the taxi industry overall and help transportation for South Floridians?
I don't know what you mean by legally.
They're regulated and they have the proper business licenses.
If they're regulated and have to go through the same hoops and loops that I have to go to and the industry has to go to protect our public, absolutely so. However, you got to understand that their model doesn't work like that. Their model would totally fall apart if they had to buy commercial insurance, go to 4 inspections a year. These people are driving you around with their GEICO insurance, sir. They have an umbrella, but as soon as the insurance company finds out that the driver is driving commercially, they're not going to cover your accident. As they say, don't get in the car with a stranger. You're all taking your lives into your hands, absolutely. So I would never let one of my children drive in one of these.
Diego Feliciano, president of the South Florida Taxi Association. We've got to move on here. Rosemary, to the point of insurance, that may be the point with the insurance and regulations, that we get an inflection point in terms of these peer-to-peer car services and where regulators perhaps come in and begin to see some kind of more stricter rules coming into place and manage this industry and manage the disruption.
Well, I think insurance is an issue that businesses have to deal with, and I'm not familiar with how Uber is protecting itself, but if it's
a
business
passengers.
Or its passengers, but it does need to address its liabilities or it won't be in business long. But my takeaway from this conversation continues to be that competition is good, that because of this disruptor in the market, we might see cleaner taxis, we might see credit card machines in taxis, we might see taxis willing to take people places that they now are resisting wanting to go. So competition is good. It makes everybody better.
Lauren Pastrana, an illegal cab ride or a regulated cab ride for you and your family?
It's all about convenience. Whoever can get to me fastest is the car that I'm going to jump in.
There's the competition right there. Lauren Pastrana with CBS Miami, Glenn Garvin with the Miami Herald, and Rosemary Goodrow, Sun Sentinel editorial page editor. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Stay close. Still to come, documenting a personal journey of being an undocumented immigrant in the U.S. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. In 2007, gunfire erupted on the campus of Virginia Tech. A senior student shot and killed 32 people. 17 were wounded. Jose Antonio Vargas covered the shooting, the investigation, and the aftermath of the violence. He was part of the Washington Post team that won the Pulitzer Prize. 4 years later, Vargas wrote publicly for the first time about his immigration status. He was undocumented. He has since directed a film about his experience called Documented, and the film is at O Cinema in Miami Friday and Saturday. He joins us now, Jose Antonio Vargas, director of Documented. Welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're joined as well by Tim Padgett, our America's editor here at WLRN. When did you first learn you were undocumented, Jose?
4 years after I arrived here, after my mother sent me to live with her parents.
You were 12 years old when you came.
I was 12 when I came from the Philippines. And then when I went to the DMV to get a driver's permit, that's when I found out that the green card and the passport that my grandfather had given me was fake.
You were 16. You went on to graduate high school. You went on to work in journalism, a successful career. Did you purposely hide your undocumented status?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Well, I didn't know, and this was before there was Google, so you couldn't really, and as somebody who wasn't Mexican, because when I was growing up in California, everybody thought, you know, illegal meant Mexican, so I did not tell anybody. I mean, I ended up telling a couple of teachers at school, in my high school, because they were the ones that ended up trying to figure out how to get me to college, because back then, there was no in-state tuition, and yeah, so... But for me, I was really lucky that a year after I found that I was undocumented, I discovered journalism. And I figured, this is going to sound really silly, but I figured that if I didn't have the right papers to be here, what if I'm on the paper? Like my name on the paper? Like a byline?
In the newspaper. In the byline, yeah.
So I thought, so I thought that was a way to just say that I'm here.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, that's interesting. And I remember my grandmother looking at it going like, what are you doing? Like, you're supposed to be hiding. Like, why are you on the paper?
Lauren Pastrana from CBS Miami. It's like it's living your lie out loud. And, not only that, but acknowledging it in public.
And after your grandmother tells you to hide it, what was the fear like when you finally decided, for lack of a better term, to come out with your status?
You know, I was very privileged to have built a career in journalism. You know, I was covering the 2008 campaign, like being on Hillary Clinton's plane, covering Huckabee in Iowa. I mean, I was mortified and scared the whole time. And I guess once I decided that I couldn't live like that anymore, it was as if, I mean, I spent all of my teens and all of my 20s being afraid of this government.
Are you still undocumented?
Yeah. So because actually that's probably the number one question that people like me get asked is like, why don't you just make yourself legal? As if all we can do is like get on the corner of what? Get in the corner here downtown and get in a line and like get a form. It doesn't work like that.
Right.
No matter how many times politicians say, get in the back of the line, there is no line. It doesn't exist, right? That's why we need reform to happen.
And to that end, when it comes to a state like Florida, which is on the front lines of immigration, everybody knows that, certainly.
Presidential, especially with the presidential campaign coming up.
Absolutely. Yes. Our state legislature this past spring approved, after 2 years plus of debating, in-state tuition, lower tuition for colleges and universities, for state colleges and universities, for undocumented students.
Yeah.
How big of a sea change is that?
Well, I mean, I in some ways, Florida has actually been behind several states, like California, right, and Texas. I mean, this is where Governor Perry was really ahead of the curve. You know, I mean, Governor Perry supported in-state tuition for undocumented students since, you know, the early 2000s, right? So it's about time that Florida does that. And again, what are we supposed to do with these kids, right? Like, we have invested in them already. They go to public schools. I mean, they should have the opportunity to contribute to the country and the state that they call their home. So to me, it makes total sense. And I think the rest of the American public, poll after poll, has shown that this makes sense. And yet we don't have a federal Dream Act, by the way. Like, this is happening, like LGBT rights, immigrant rights right now is happening state
by state.
State. by state.
That's right. In fact, the president, though, had called immigration his number two priority
number
in his
two.
Second administration. Right. Jose Antonio Vargas, director of Documented. This is a film that's being shown this weekend here in South Florida, Friday and Saturday at O Cinema in Miami. Next week, after almost 6 years of planning, the World Cup finally kicks off in Brazil. Whether or not it's ready, transportation strikes, traffic tie-ups, you name it, reporter Andrew Downey sent us this audio postcard from São Paulo.
I'm standing on a street in Brazil, the land of soccer. This is São Paulo, the city that will host the opening match of the World Cup next week. And if you can hear traffic honking behind me, that's no surprise. Metro workers are on strike for the second day, and with many people taking their cars to work, some of the longest jams of the year have developed. But traffic chaos might not be Brazil's biggest problem over the next 5 weeks. During last year's Confederations Cup, millions of Brazilians took to the streets to protest. The protest began over hikes in bus fares, but soon grew to focus on the government and soccer's governing body, FIFA. Many Brazilians feel too much money is being spent on stadiums for the rich and not enough on long-neglected services for the poor. Brazil won the right to host the World Cup in 2007, but they delayed 2 years before even choosing the host cities, and progress has been similarly slow ever since. More than half the promised infrastructure projects won't be ready. Some were never even started. The 12 stadiums are ready, or sort of. They're still adding seats in some venues a week before kickoff. Last week I was at the arena that will host the World Cup's opening match. Some parts of it wouldn't look out of place in the Four Seasons Hotel. Other parts were unfinished, with exposed scaffolding and workers scurrying around in hard hats. It was the perfect illustration of Brazil's inequalities. Yesterday I was at a press conference with FIFA's bigwigs. Some of them reportedly were in traffic jams for 3 hours before they got there. This morning, with more rain and more strikes, collective tailbacks have exceeded 150 miles. It's just another day in São Paulo. This is Andrew Downey in São Paulo, Brazil.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLR, and you've traveled extensively throughout Brazil over the course of many, many decades. What's your sense of the readiness of Brazil to host the attention of the world in next week?
Well, look, even soccer's legend, legendary striker Ronaldo, a few days ago, said he was appalled by the lack of preparation. So that's a pretty damning criticism right there, and I think it reflects the feelings of most Brazilians. This is the most soccer-passionate country in the world, and yet polls now are showing that most Brazilians are utterly unenthusiastic about hosting the World Cup because of these non-readiness problems.
Yeah, Kenny Malone with WLRN here, a soccer aficionado if there ever was one here in South Florida. But you've got the some of the globe's soccer powers coming through South Florida to prepare for playing in Brazil. Any voices of concerns about the infrastructure problems that they may encounter?
I mean, the folks who were down here were focused first and foremost on not worrying so much about the infrastructure and worrying a lot more about the climate in Brazil. That's why they were here to begin with. The British national team, the English national team, was spending some time at Sun Life Stadium, and the English media was obsessed with our weather, in particular the torrential rain that happened the day after England got here. And so headlines all over England, you know, rain ruins Roy Hodgson. This is the English coach. Ray ruins Roy Hodgson's work in Miami as England training is hit by a storm. There seemed to be a lack of understanding about what rainy season means exactly. And so we have a soundbite here from Hodgson after they finally got a practice in.
How helpful were the weather conditions today?
Good. It was nice. Nice to see the sun, and it was warm out there, and the conditions, I think, are very similar to the conditions we'll encounter in Brazil. So it was absolutely perfect today, and nice that we get back to some degree of normality here in Florida.
Normality, right? So I just want to say, whoever is doing the PR for Florida in England is not getting paid enough, because everybody appears to think it's sunny all the time,
even during the rainy season.
Apparently,
even during the rainy season. I guess if your metric is the UK, right, and the weather in London and around London, maybe, you know, a drizzle is sunny. Who knows? Kenny Malone for WLRN, Tim Padgett from WLRN as well, Lauren Pastrana with CBS Miami. Great to have you for the full hour here on the Florida Roundup. That is our program.